In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'll be yakking it up with Matt Friction of the Pink Spiders. They're based in Nashville, Tennessee, and began back in 2003. Wound up issuing several albums, and then they had a hiatus or an inactive period, then returning with a full length in 2018. Next month they'll release their latest. It's their fifth album, and it's called Freakazoid. It's home to our recent coolest song in the world, Freakin' Freakin' Out. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Matt on your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred with your coolest conversations, and joining me today is Matt Friction, lead singer and guitarist in the Pink Spiders out of Nashville, Tennessee. Their track Freakin' Freakin' Out is off the upcoming album Freakazoid, and this is our coolest song in the world this week. Matt, how are you?
Man, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, man, thank you for joining me. Now, you're a Nashville boy, right? Were you born and raised there?
That's right, born and raised.
Did either of your parents work in the music industry?
No. No one in my family, actually.
Okay, so this is even more interesting now. So, you play guitar. When did you start playing guitar?
When I was 16 years old, I found my mom's acoustic guitar in the attic, and it had a Jimmy Buffett tab book for the greatest hits. And so I taught myself how to play every Jimmy Buffett song, which had most of the chords you need to know, and started a punk band, and that's kind of how it got started.
Well, so you discovered the guitar up there. What? Why even start playing guitar?
I don't know. I guess just being 16, that's just kind of one of those things. I was really kind of getting into, you know, grunge music and stuff, you know, kind of dating myself a little bit. But that's kind of that was the thing when I was in high school, and seemed like the kind of thing that I could do. And so, you know.
So you pull this guitar out of the attic. Did your mom kind of go like, what are you doing with that? What do you think you're going to do with that? Was she encouraging at all?
I don't remember the reaction. I don't think that they expected it to be the thing that I did for the next several decades, but I think that it was just something that occupied me. I think they would have probably rathered I spent time with homework, but that was like all I could do was just kind of, I got hyper focused and fixated on it and just didn't really have any idea about music theory or how any of it worked, but I was just, once you start to kind of learn just those basic chords, you kind of hear like Beatles stuff and you hear like, you know, not to diss on Jimmy Buffett or anything, but more music that I actually listen to, and then being able to kind of use, it's like, oh, these are the same chords in these rock and roll songs too. So I didn't learn playing power chords like most people, which I think is kind of why we're not as punk as a lot of our contemporaries. I'm more of like a song structure and chord progression guy.
A chord progression.
Yeah, I like weird chord progressions. I like the Zombies and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, there's a Kink song, Session Man chord progression,
yeah,
which I think he's taken a stab or a jab at Jimmy Page. Ray Davies is with that one. So, but so your mom, obviously a Jimmy Buffett fan. Was there much music in the household at all, or was this something that you kind of zeroed into sort of as you're going through your adolescence?
Yeah, my dad had a pretty big record collection, and okay, it was all, you know, the classic rock and roll stuff. So that's one of my earliest memories is in the summertime when school's out, when I was a little kid, pretending I was a DJ, you know, just playing a record and then talking to nobody and then putting another record on and playing a song and listening to it. And he had all the classics, the Beatles and Stones and the Who, and that was my earliest, you know, memories of music, was just kind of getting lost in those record collection.
So you're 16, you find the guitar, you start figuring chords out via Jimmy Buffett. He was the gateway.
It was.
Then you started playing in bands in high school. Was it one of these Silent Friction?
Yeah, that was the one towards the end of high school. Yeah. Before that, there was a band called, there's a million bands as high school kind of tends to be, but
yeah,
I never sang in any of the bands. I always wrote the songs, but I was really too scared to sing. And Silent Friction, the female vocalist that was in all of the bands I was in before that, went off to college, so I had to just be the singer all of a sudden. And that's kind of how that band was born, was trying to figure that out.
was a Silent Friction a reference to you not really wanting to sing?
Yeah, I guess so. I, you know, it was kind of more just like being young and just putting words together that don't make any sense, and like, that sounds cool.
Well, when did the Pink Spiders officially form then?
That was in 2003 in the summer. I had toured with another band. Basically, once I graduated high school, I really just wanted to get on the road. And the Silent Friction guys did not really want to do that. They wanted to have, you know, normal lives and just be in a band. And so I would go on tour playing guitar with really anybody that would take me, just like getting in a van, sleeping on floors, like anything I could do. But I really wanted to do it, you know, with my music. And so that's kind of where the Pink Spiders were born. It was kind of taking some members from some bands I'd played with and finding guys that liked the same kind of music that I did, and going from there.
Well, when was the last time you went to the Viper Room in LA?
Oh man, we played a bar mitzvah in Hollywood. I don't know that anyone even knows this, but we did this during a hiatus where we weren't really a band for a few years. We just were flown out there by kind of a super fan and played a bar mitzvah. And we did a secret show at the Viper Room, thinking I will go back to kind of like home base in Hollywood. And it was a little too much of a secret, because I think there were maybe 10 people there. We realized we probably should have announced this and promoted it.
Well, I mean, that is encouraging to humanity, though, that people can keep a secret.
Yes.
A little too well. Well, can you share the story about you guys getting signed after having a performance there?
Yeah. So, you know, we started the band in 2003. We put out an EP on our own, which got us some attention from a label called CI Records, which is a small punk label in Pennsylvania. They put out our full length Hot Pink in 2004. And at that point, we didn't even have apartments. We didn't have jobs. We just toured all the time, probably 10 months out of the year, sometimes booking shows from the road, just trying to stay gone as much as we could, you know, playing house shows, VFW halls, art spaces, like anyone that would have us. And at some point, an old friend of mine was managing bands in LA, and he liked our album, which had sold, I think, like 1,000 CDs at the time. And he was like, let me try to get some interest from some labels here, which, you know, we had pretty measured expectations at that point. Right. And I just remember, I had never been on an airplane at that time. I think I was 22 or 23, but so he kind of worked it all out. He's like, I have a showcase. We have a couple labels coming, some small indie labels will come see you play. We'll put you up in a little apartment for a couple of days. You play the show. And I was just thrilled to go to LA for the first time and be on an airplane for the first time. And I remember we played a house show in Muncie, Indiana, 2 days before and slept on the floor there. And then we, you know, just flew out on Frontier Airlines to Hollywood to just have this kind of experience. And somehow, not really due to the merits of the band or like any, you know, momentum we had or anything, they're just kind of, it got out of control, which I've kind of learned is a thing that happens just with LA entertainment politics. And someone found out that someone was going to be there and someone saw a picture and was like, these are, you know, guys, this could be like a Blink 182 thing, or this could be Weezer, or like, I don't know, whatever thing they were trying to project on us. But it kind of got out of control to where all of a sudden there were, I think, like 18 labels there and everyone's trying to buy the booths and like kind of, I don't know if I can say, swing your D around and kind of they just kind of like be, you know, be big players or whatever. And it became this, you know, we played our show like we always do, just kind of sloppy and drunk and cigarettes on stage in the Viper Room, which we got in trouble for. And then I was like, that was, you know, that was exciting. They're going to kind of realize this isn't the thing that you want to put a whole bunch of money behind. But, you know, the exact opposite happened and it became a big bidding war and we were kind of flown around and wined and dined. And the whole time everyone thought we were teenagers, we were in our early 20s, but, you know, everyone was trying to like take us to Disney World and stuff. I was like, we're not that young. And ultimately, we ended up signing with Geffen because that's just kind of the label, you know, from when I was a teenager that had Weezer and Nirvana and, you know, Teenage Fan Club and, you know, all those bands. Like I remember the DGC Rarities compilations that would come out and kind of, you know, put a little bit too much importance on what that label was a couple of decades prior. But
right.
You know, they had other bands, you know, that kind of made sense. And they had a lot of enthusiasm for us. Really, that was the big thing too at the time I just didn't want to, I wanted to go with someone that I felt like kind of got what we were doing and it seemed like they did at the time.
You know, I guess it's just really not unusual for bands to have a falling out with their label. And I guess that was the case with you and Geffen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I thought would happen was if we took the biggest deal that, you know, and that was kind of what the band had agreed on, we'll just take the biggest deal and they'll be so over leveraged on us that they can't give up on us. And that's not how it works. They will cut bait so fast if they, you know, put a lot of resources behind an act and it doesn't pretty immediately pay off. And we had an option early on to kind of put the first record out. We did that, our first album with Rick Ocasek at Electric Lady Studios, really just kind of an over the top, you know, dream scenario that also is incredibly expensive. And so found ourselves in a situation where we were, you know, not well loved in the building after we were so deeply in the red that quickly.
And the second album for Geffen, which I guess is your third overall, that's Sweat It Out, is that correct?
That's Sweat It Out, which we made for Geffen, which I was kind of under the impression we would get dropped pretty quickly, but they gave us a chance to make another one. So we spent another small fortune making an album, which ultimately got us dropped. They were pretty excited about it. I remember everyone coming in the studios. We did it with Brendan O'Brien, who is to this day maybe the most talented person I've ever met. And it's a record that I'm really proud of. It just wasn't, they really thought that we were going to be a punk band. And I was trying to make a Jellyfish album. And they were just like, what is this? And so at first there was kind of an open mind. They're like, oh, maybe this is like, you know, this will transcend to top 40. And like, there's like that, you see the kind of wheels turning in their heads, like, oh, this could be a crossover kind of band. And then they're like, actually, this doesn't make any sense, and I don't know why we signed this band. But we got to make an album that we couldn't have made otherwise. Like that kind of kitchen sink approach. Like, you know, we had made our first album, Hot Pink, we had made in a garage for $900. And then the next two albums, pretty much with the maximum budget that, you know, at that time, anyone probably was spending on things. So at least got to do two kind of just like life-changing fun experiences where there's no punches pulled. You know, we just got to do exactly what we wanted to do, and then got dropped and got to do whatever we could do within our own budget from then on.
Well, you know, you mentioned when you guys are touring, and you were playing like 10 months out of the year, mm-hmm. constantly on the road, and that's got to be, well, I know that's a huge stress, because you do that and you can't, I mean, it was really, really hard to maintain any other type of relationship outside of the band. And then put in that pressure cooker where you're with the guys all the time. I mean, there's any friction there that gets it's heightened, you know, accentuated. Then you've got this pressure from record company trying to make, you know, the records they want versus what you're trying to do. So I mean, I'm not surprised that there's a gap there, right? We went on a hiatus. Were those the things that played into taking a break, or what else was going on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the main thing, the band definitely, because we were like brothers and we loved each other, we were like, we're not like normal people. We can live together at home, and we can be together in a bus, and we can be together in a venue, we can be on tour, we can just be in each other's spaces 365 days out of the year, because we're not like normal people. And that turned out not to be true. Like, you know, I think that there's no one that you want to spend that much time with. And so obviously any like animosity or any, it really ultimately wasn't a big personal falling out. It was just, I think that we had a little bit of taste of like the good life when it was like, oh man, like we're flying first class and we're just like zooming in for this big festival, and then we're zooming back to and it's just, we knew early on, we're like, we'll just take the biggest deal and we will get, you know, somebody over leveraged, and whatever happens from there, we'll just have so much exposure that we can always go back to what we did and just be in a van and play to 200 people. We'll just be able to do that forever, and that was always the plan. But then once it actually happens and you're like kind of disenfranchised by that kind of falling off, I think that everyone kind of, not so much myself, but the other two guys, I think they were like, oh, it didn't work, and kind of forgot that the plan was just, you know, if it works, great. If it doesn't, you know, this is, it's like shoot for the stars and whatever that phrase is, shoot for the stars and wherever you land is better than wherever you were before.
Yeah.
That's definitely not it, but something like that. it's just like that ebb and flow of success, feeling, you know, once you get dropped from a label and you get dropped from management, and there is like that kind of taste in your mouth of not living up to expectations, and you know, kind of having some baggage now, like whenever there's like a show, it's like, you know, I wish we were a one hit wonder, but we don't even have a hit.
So there's like I guess a 10-year gap between Sweat It Out and the 2018 album Mutations. Mm-hmm. Do you think of that? Is that the comeback album? I mean, that you're sort of back on the scene again. How does that fit into the story, Mutations?
We had released, like self-released, some singles, and then I think in 2011, like there always were little glimpses of being a band again. That bar mitzvah that we played was sometime around that time, I want to say 2012 or 2013. So it was always kind of in the back of our minds. Like we didn't really announce a hiatus that I remember. I think it just was, we just didn't do anything.
Yeah.
I made other, you know, I went and made a solo album in Sausalito, California with Jerry Harrison from Modern Lovers and Talking Heads, who's a great friend of mine and is kind of early champion of the band, and tried to make that happen, but I just didn't really know, you know, I didn't really have a good idea like how that worked as a solo artist, where the band, you you're just this traveling gang, and like every, especially that time, like everything we did, it was kind of us against the world. And then when it's just me against the world, I was like, this sucks. there's no help, there's no team, there's no money behind it, and it's pretty easy to get discouraged. Just, you know, when there's bad news, when you're in a band, you kind of just live through it together. And when there's bad news as a solo artist, you just kind of stew in it. And so, the Pink Spiders as a band was not really active, but still, you know, still saw each other. I didn't really expect to do much again, mainly just because of that feeling, like I mentioned, where it just kind of felt like no one cared about it anymore. And, then on the 10-year anniversary of the Teenage Graffiti album that we made, the first Geffen album, we did just a reunion show, a one-off in Nashville, and we booked it in a 200 capacity club in town. And Nashville was never really a great city for us in terms of our like fan base. Maybe a top 50 city, but like it's one of those things where your hometown kind of doesn't buy into the mythology of, you know, they're like, we just see those dudes playing pool at a bar, like they're not, this isn't anything special,
right?
So we just did it. We wanted to do kind of like a small thing and just hang out with friends, and there was just a lot more interest in it. Not anything overwhelming, but that show sold out the first day, so we moved it to a bigger club, and it ended up selling out, like a 500 capacity club, and people flew in from literally all over the world just because we hadn't done anything in so long. And I think that, you know, seeing that there was some interest in it, and kind of remembering that there was an audience for this creative outlet was really important to me, because that's all I've ever wanted out of it. Like I don't mind even having a regular job if I still have, you know, people listening to songs that I've written. That's it. That's the end goal for me.
Do you have a regular job?
These days, I own a bar in East Nashville, which I manage, and that's like my quote unquote day job. That's actually what myself and our guitar player, he has a couple of bars, and so we're just, I don't know
what is your bar?
It's called Rosemary and Beauty Queen. I have two partners here, and it's in Five Points in East Nashville. And yeah, that's kind of what we do. Restaurateurs or bar guys. It's kind of, you know, once I got off tour full time, I just went and bartended at local rock clubs, the Mercy Lounge and Exit Inn in Nashville. Yeah. Both are kind of no longer around, but they're just kind of institutions in town. And like, that is like, I know about music and touring, and I know about drinking, so this is what I'm qualified for. And pretty quickly kind of just started working full-time at Mercy Lounge, eventually became a bar manager, and eventually became the general manager and dealt more with the concert side of things and booking shows and dealing with artists and advancing shows and all that stuff that I actually had real experience doing. So that's what I did for the most time. And then we realized,
so the bar that you have now, do you book shows there?
We do not. Okay. So my two partners also came from working with me at Mercy Lounge. Actually, one of them hired me there. And I think our takeaway was, we love music and we love going to shows and festivals, and this is not what we want to spend our time doing. Let's just sell booze to people. So this bar is specifically very much not a music venue, even though our investors are musicians and we're a hang for lots and lots of musicians. It's just one of those things in Nashville where everything has live music. So if you don't, it's kind of like
a refuge.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I saw a Facebook post where you mentioned that the new album, the upcoming album, Freakazoid, was made during the pandemic. And yes. Now, before the pandemic began, had you already scheduled studio time to do another album? Or because it was the pandemic, you thought, well, we might as well try and make an album?
We were ready to go into a studio, and we were looking around to kind of find the right place. We had just wrapped a tour with I think possibly our mutual friend, the Dolly Rots, Kelly Dolly Rot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd done the tour with them, and it was the best time. And then we were like, all right, we've done 2 years of touring on this album that we put out ourselves. There's not a whole lot left to do with it. So it's time for a new one. And we were late 2019, early 2020. We were just kind of like texting each other ideas. And that's when everything kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
And we had the songs, which ended up not being all the same songs, as that kind of tends to change, but especially with the amount of time we spent on it, we had 10 songs, and we were just like, I'm a type 1 diabetic, and we were just all being pretty safe about, you know, just kind of staying in our houses and you know, not putting ourselves in any additional risk. So we just kind of, we figured out how to upload sessions into a cloud, and I'm relatively tech savvy. Two of the guys are very much not, and so we were just running into all of these really technical boring issues with like, oh, you recorded at the wrong bit rate, or this is like just things like that. And
yeah,
you're like, you're pushing the second chorus, but it doesn't push. And instead of it happening in real time in a studio and just correcting it, it's like 2 weeks of waiting for a session, dropping it into my session, realizing there's a problem. And it was nice to have all this time, you know, to write and to work on it. And I mean, every one of our albums, I don't know how to quantify the amount of hours spent on it, but this album is definitely 100 times as much time as I've ever spent making an album. Just because there were no limits. There wasn't any end of a studio session. I had no job to go to. I had no place to be. So I just really worked on this album and nitpicked everything to the point of really kind of not enjoying it a lot of the times, and driving the band crazy and rearranging songs as they'd already been tracked, and just like really just kind of being a miserable prick about it. And there is something nice about the spontaneity of just being in a studio and being like, all right, that's it. That was a good take. Let's move on. And just never having that moment, you know, not to compare ourselves to Leonardo da Vinci, but the famous quote is, great art is never completed. It's only abandoned. And you can't abandon it if it's just sitting in your lap forever. So we just really worked on this album nonstop, you know, trying not to kill each other remotely. And we got to the point where then we were able to get back together, and we just had this kind of mess that we had sent out to some mixers to try to like figure it out. But they were like, they were sending us back mixes, and we're like, yeah, it's just a lot of times it doesn't sound like we were in the same place at the same time, because
right.
We were. And so ultimately we retracked a lot of it, and like the sessions are the same sessions. So these sessions just have all this just mess in them of like old takes and new takes and like chopped up this and that. And the sessions that are on our record are the sessions, you know, from that took 2 to 3 years to finish. But I'd hope to never have to make something this way again.
We mentioned Rick Ocasek and Brendan O'Brien at various points, you know, producing you guys. This album, Freakazoid, you produced yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've been kind of just saying we recorded it because it's, I don't know. I mean, Hot Pink was kind of the same way, where it was just a band in the studio. And then I feel like kind of what Brendan and Rick did was a little bit more like producer role, is being the fourth or fifth member of the band.
Right.
Has like not more sway than anyone, but kind of, you know, if Brendan was like, man, I don't know, like this solo is twice as long as it should be, I usually didn't fight him on it because he was right so often. And so when you're producing it yourself, it's kind of more like, I don't know, we just recorded it. It's kind of the way that I think of it. We recorded the songs, and you know, the arrangement of the songs is the bulk of the production work on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, our coolest song in the world this week, freaking out. Well, when did you write that?
This was actually the first song. I couldn't remember. So Devotion and freaking out were very early on. And I think because they're a little more in the new wave, kind of on the grid, like Cars influenced songs, they kind of worked better for that very structured sending tracks back and forth kind of thing. The loose rock and roll songs are the ones where you're like, this just sounds sloppy. It doesn't sound like we were drunk together in a room. It sounds like everyone was in a whole different mindset. But yeah, this was one of the first ones that was written, I would maybe as early as 2018 or 2019, like kind of when I first started just getting ideas for another record.
Have you ever seen the Russ Meyer film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
I don't think I have.
It got a great scene in there where it's this infamous sort of party scene. And, you know, Roger Ebert wrote the screenplay. He's got a character in there called Z-Man, who's kind of this Phil Spector guy. And the famous quote or the line of the dialogue is, this is my happening and it's freaking me out. And so you got to check that out. What inspired freaking out?
I remember this. So some of the songs have, at least in my process of writing, like kind of placeholder lyrics, and then try to figure out like what is going to be the real lyric and what's going to be the real hook. And I remember this always. I have a puppy. Not even a puppy anymore. She's a full grown dog. Her name is Duck, and
dog is Duck?
She's a little beagle.
Oh, that's great. Well, I have a little dog. He's like a dachshund mix. His name's Charlie.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a boxer named Lucy and a beagle named Duck. And Duck, I just call her the freak or the freakazoid or like the big freak, and like that's just kind of her nickname. She like does that. I forget what it's called. Like a greyhound kind of thing where she kind of pulls her lip up and shows her top teeth. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
It's a weird dog thing, but yeah. So I kind of will just sing songs to the dogs, and like that was kind of a hook. You're freaking me out. I'm freaking out. Whatever. Like just kind of like a loose version of what this song is, singing it to her. And I remember just like kind of being like, okay, I'm gonna make this like a real thing. And then as I was writing it, I was like, that's a placeholder lyric. It's obviously nonsense. I'm not going to use this in the song. And as we get further and further along, like the rest of the song kind of coalesces around it. And I'm just eventually, I has happened a few times in my life with songwriting, I just give up and I'm like, that's the lyric. I have to make sense now. I kind of wrote a song around that very nonsense sentiment of singing a song to a puppy who has a weird lip.
You mentioned the tune Devotion. That's available now as a single. It's got a pretty cool video. Can you describe the video for us?
Yeah, so we did that here in town with a bunch of drag queens that we're friends with. And we kind of had this idea going. Tennessee's been in the news a lot lately for some pretty regressive state political action taking towards LGBTQ community and drag performances in particular. And we didn't make the video as any kind of like protest or response to it. We were just doing it anyways. We were like, this song should be a really fun party. Who are the funnest people that we know? And our bass player does, he's like a DJ and does all these like drag brunches. And so we're friends with a lot of them. We're like, could we get them to kind of like, we'll just be playing. And initially it was kind of a Top of the Pops kind of concept. It was going to be, you know, it has that element, but we kind of modernized it a little bit by the time that it actually got finished. But really like soft lenses and like lens flares and like the slow panning and just that kind of thing, and like very faked performance. We kind of really wanted to capture that. We're like, how do we do that? Where we're just kind of standing and being kind of weird, then make it visually compelling. And we're like, oh, we'll just bring them on. And like, it was wild to me. I mean, they're like almost everything that they do in the video is first take. They just like I didn't see them even plan or talk about anything. It's just kind of choreographed. And then they just grab the instruments and they're there for a couple hours and just steal the show. And I was like, this is exactly what we wanted. So then everything kind of happens with the governor of Tennessee and all this stuff, you know, with, you know, trying to ban drag performances in town. We're like, okay, well, great. Well, now we can actually kind of put this video out as a show of support and, you know, allyship. And yeah, that's kind of how it all happened.
Another favorite track of mine off the upcoming album Freakazoid is "You're the One." You got a line in there about being a Hollywood vampire. Did you ever ask Johnny Depp about that? You want in?
No.
Yeah. I like the lyric in there too. The lyric is, "You've got a future and I've got a past." I like that. That's a great turn of phrase.
Am I mistaken? Are the Hollywood vampires? Wasn't that like Lennon and like all?
Well, originally, right? But since then, Johnny Depp got together with Alice Cooper, and I think Cooper was involved with those guys originally. But they formed an actual band, the Hollywood Vampires, and they put out at least two albums. Now I can't remember.
Really? I didn't realize. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that. I was thinking of like the Harry Nilsson. Yeah.
Right. Well, then that's, you know, that's even cooler.
Yeah. That's the Hollywood Vampire. I mean, you know, Alice Cooper is obviously one of the greatest, one of my favorites, but I want to be that Hollywood Vampire.
Well, do you play golf?
I don't. But
yeah, I don't play golf either. But apparently, Alice Cooper loves playing golf, so that could be another way. You know, if you play golf. Well, when did you come up with "You're the One"?
That I wrote that song. I wrote the chord progression and melody for that song when I was making the solo record in Sausalito, and I can't play piano, but I wrote it kind of on guitar, and then I just kind of did like a MIDI really bad piano version. I really just like those like long chord progressions with a bunch of quirky little, you know, I don't know any music theory, but you know, seventh chords and just like that kind of thing. And I was like kind of messing around with that, and I had the melody and I had all the piano stuff, and I was like, I don't know if this is a Pink Spider song. And so I didn't end up finishing it. And then just kind of digging through some old demos when we were making this album, I was like, I like this. I should make this into something. So did a little bit of rearrangement and, you know, kind of made it a little more of a Pink Spiders thing. And that's kind of how that came to be.
Let's think here for a second. When you started off initially, it was bass guitar and drums, right? That was the lineup, the musically?
That was the official lineup, but we always had a touring guitar player who was not an official member.
Right, and on the new album, the upcoming album, you've got a guy playing keys on there, synth and keys, Diamond Dave Paulson. Is he in the band?
He was the touring guitar player in the original lineup. He is retired from road life, so I just kind of bring him in because he kind of is a big part of the Pink Spiders sound and kind of getting our, especially keyboards and synthesizer stuff, like that's his whole world. So he's not touring with us. We either don't have the keyboard tracks, or if they're like really easy, we'll have them in there.
Yeah. Well, you guys have got a show July the 6th in Nashville. I saw on Nashville at the Brooklyn Bowl, playing with Les and Jake and the Voodoo Glow Skulls. Is that the record release show?
Yeah. So, yeah, we've kind of appropriated that show to be, we're the first band playing a half an hour. It's also our album release show, but we got permission to call it such. And so, yeah, it'll be the album comes out the next day on the 7th, but we're able to release it a day early in our hometown and kind of celebrate with our friends at that show.
Well, I think that's excellent. I mean, the best, you know, if it's your record release party, why the hell do you even want to play, you know? Let those so a 30-minute set, that's great. And then you can, you know, people can get the new record, you can hang out and then have somebody else playing, you know, so you can enjoy yourself.
I can't tell you how much I love being the first band, like setting all the stuff up, playing a short amount of time, going and having fun. Like, it is so stress-free.
So I don't know if you ever heard of the Woggles, but I play in a band called the Woggles. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we over the years we played, you know, the Exit Inn a number of times, and it's pretty much employee nights when we would have a show there. But you know, for the employees,
I know.
Couple of times it was the Grimies, which was, you know, a lot of fun. But the reason I bring this up is that twice we were hired by this ska band, the Pie Tasters, to play their record release parties. So they would actually play their record and everyone would mingle, right? And then they would have us play and then they could just enjoy a show.
Yeah.
That was always very fun. Yeah. So you have that July 6th show. After that, you're making your way with a lot of shows up to New York City in September. You're going to the Midwest, the West Coast. Do you ever play overseas much?
We haven't in a long time. We did, I think, two UK tours in like the late 2000s, mostly like festivals. There's a festival called Give It a Name, and we actually went over there for a handful of dates with Fall Out Boy. But yeah, it's been a really long time. I don't know, you know, it's something that we'd like to do. It's something that we tell everyone we want to do, but it's not something that is materialized.
Well, you get the new album out, Freakazoid comes out, you don't know. You never know. You'll be playing a festival over there.
Yeah. So we've had a lot of love on like Apple Music playlists, and I think that there's, I don't know, some tangential occurrence where we're now get like that's some like basically Japan is kind of blowing up as a location where we're being streamed, which to me, you know, I'm just bothering the label and management and agent, like, look, we're doing great, we really really should probably go to Japan. And they're like, yeah, this is people that are like exercising with this playlist on of like American rock music, and they don't know what they're listening to or care what they're listening to. It's not translating to actual, you know, listeners. And I was like, I don't know, the data doesn't lie. I think we need to go to Japan.
I think you do too. You know, if you need me to help convince these people, I'm telling you.
All right. You up on that?
Well, the other tune we want to take a listen to today off of Freakazoid is Baby I'm High. And you were talking about there in Tennessee, the whole thing about the drag shows. Well, medical and recreational marijuana is illegal there. Mm-hmm. Has that ever been a problem for you?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's fairly decriminalized in certain amounts. And for the most part, there's all the, I don't know all the science behind all like the other kinds of marijuana there are, Delta, this and that, but there's people on the street corners, you know, with little kiosks all over downtown and in East Nashville, just selling out of little containers of, you know, some kind of cannabis of some kind. I don't ask a lot of questions. I'm like, okay, that seems legit. Let's. But yeah, you can't get like, you can't legally get, you know, your gummies and vapes and like all like the convenient things that you can get most places. But yeah, I think it's one of those things where at this point, even, you know, Tennessee cops are like, you know, it's weed. Come on.
Well, Baby I'm High, what's the story on that one? How did it come together?
This is another one where the music kind of was there a long time before the lyrics were there. Kind of was messing around with this riff, and it doesn't really sound like it on the final mastered version, but I was doing what I do a lot and trying to rip off this band, Exploding Hearts, who are just one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time, who died tragically around the same time that the Pink Spiders formed. And just kind of doing this kind of noodly open chord, kind of, you know, reminiscent of the Beat or the Jam, or just like a lot of this kind of like power pop stuff that I'm really into. And I kind of had the melody for it, didn't really know what the lyrics were. And actually, I'm not a huge cannabis guy, but I love mushrooms. And so I don't know, it's a little bit of a misnomer, but I think you can be high on mushrooms. So
Matt, thank you so much for being my guest today on our Coolest Conversations.
Man, thank you so much for having me. This is a great pleasure.
Oh, man. We're going to go to the listen now to the other track off the upcoming album, Freakazoid. It's the Pink Spiders with Baby I'm High in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Portion of Baby I'm High. That's the Pink Spiders here in Little Steven's Underground Garage off their upcoming album Freakazoid, due out July the 7th. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Matt Friction for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Underground Garage favorites, the Midnight Callers. They've got a new album out now on Gem Records. It's titled Rattled Humming Heart. And the band's Martin Stubbs will join us to tell us all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.